This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson visiting the Minnesota State Fair. Pop quiz. What do cotton candy, chocolate chip cookies, and mini donuts have in common? Give up? They are all flavors of beer. Here at the fair, you can buy an array of Minnesota-brewed beers like the Cotton Candy Milkshake IPA, the Chocolate Chip Cookie Beer, and a Mini Donut Beer. 1A's Amanda Williams tried that last one yesterday. She visited the fair's Ballpark Cafe and spoke to owner Dan Tyson.
As a full pour. Wow. Right,
so this is the Mini Donut Beer.
Okay.
You'll see the sugar on the rim. And then the base is an English ale, so it's malty, and it has a cake flavoring to it. So when you start to drink it, it finishes and tastes just like a mini donut would.
Is this the first year that you guys have done it?
No, this will be our seventh year. We started this in 2013, and it continues to be our best seller and continues to grow and grow and grow. It's kind of crazy.
Wow. Where did you get the idea of putting the sugar around the rim? It's just like a margarita. Like, you guys dip it in.
Yeah, that's kind of where I thought of it. We were taste testing it. We were at the brewery, and we had done test batches. And we had the cakiness down, but it was missing like something, like deep fried or doing some piece of the mini donut. And then I don't know, about a couple weeks after we were taste testing it, I thought, oh, we should sugar the rim, cinnamon sugar the rim. So it's the same cinnamon sugar you'd get on a regular mini donut. So that's where it came up.
That was 1A's Amanda Williams with Dan Tyson, the owner of the Ballpark Cafe here at the fair. Now, back in 2008, Minnesota had fewer than 10 breweries. A decade later, there were more than 170. In that same span, the nation went from about 1,500 breweries coast to coast to more than 7,300. What's behind this boom in the beer business? Is the industry's growth a sign of a bubble? And how do Minnesota's craft brews taste? Joining us here at the Minnesota Public Radio stage is John Garland, the deputy editor of the Growler magazine, which covers the state's craft beer industry. John, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Deb Locke is the master brewer and co-owner of Urban Growler Brewing Company in St. Paul. Deb, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Omar Ansari is the founder of Surly Brewing Company in Minneapolis. Omar, glad to have you with us.
Hey, glad to be here.
We'll add a few more voices to the conversation in a bit, including some of the folks here at the Minnesota Public Radio stage. John, let me start with you. Can you paint us a clearer picture of what Minnesota's craft beer boom has looked like and what it's meant to the state?
Oh, absolutely. So once we started being able to sell pints directly from breweries is really where the growth started. It's called the so-called Surly Bill. Surly was on the forefront of making sure that manufacturing breweries can sell pints. It's a good source of revenue. It makes these smaller businesses a little more viable economically. And ever since then, the growth in breweries has exploded. It really started in the Twin Cities. Lots of breweries started in Minneapolis and St. Paul in the last 5 or 6 years. But since then, the growth has really gone outstate. In the last year or so, most of the breweries we've seen open up have been in rural Minnesota and in second and third ring suburbs. We've gone, like Joshua said, from about a dozen breweries to close to 180 at this point. And nationwide, that puts us about 15th per capita. So we have a sizable and still growing craft brewing industry here in Minnesota.
What do you think, John, makes Minnesota's breweries different from what you might see in other parts of the country?
I think we have a specifically close relationship to our raw material suppliers here. We have the world's largest single-site malting facility south of the Twin Cities in Shakopee. We also have hop growers and cooperages, a couple of oak barrel cooperages in northern Minnesota that send oak barrels all throughout the country. And we also have smaller malting facilities as well that are opening up, creating some more specific grains that brewers can play with. So really close provenance to our raw materials here.
Omar Ansari, John mentioned the Surly Bill. Let me ask you about that. It passed in May of 2011, named after your brewery. Talk about how that bill came to be.
Well, the idea for the bill came about with the idea to build a bigger brewery, to build a new facility. We were sort of hamstrung by the way the laws worked. We could only get so big. And then we had to make a big jump to get any bigger. So it wasn't incremental, but more kind of exponential growth. And the way the laws worked that we couldn't sell a pint, it just was a massive undertaking to make that happen. In a lot of states, you have the ability to sell a pint of beer, which means you can get people out to your brewery, you can grow your brand, you can also sell pints of beer, which really does help make the whole process work, helps make the math work. So that was where the idea started from, and took it to the legislature, and Not a lot got done that year, and the taproom bill or Surly bill was one of the ones that did get done. I like to think that beer is bipartisan. And, you know, for us, one of the biggest things was, well, we can go do this in Wisconsin right now. So 45 minutes away is Hudson, but we'd rather build a brewery here in Minnesota. And I think we've seen the outcome of that is all of these breweries, all of these small communities having places, because breweries become community centers for a lot of areas. And it's great to see how many smaller towns around the state have embraced that as sort of their town center.
Deb, let me come to you. Urban Growler Brewing. How did you start that business? What made you decide to get in the brewing business?
So I was a longtime home brewer, and my partner Jill and I went to a lot of tap rooms and breweries around the country, and we, as women, we like beer. And we went to a lot of tap rooms and breweries, and we realized that we weren't marketed to, and that there was an opportunity there to pay attention to women, never at the exclusion of men. But our mission was really to put a product out there and a story and bring people together to focus on bringing it to more people, and that was women included.
I have never understood why warm businesses don't cater to women. Women make like 75% of all purchasing decisions. Did you discover when you started to create this brewery that the audience kind of was there? Did you have to go find customers? How did that go?
Well, interestingly, when we first opened, we never broadcast out there that we were women-owned. It was just, we hoped people would come just for the beer, that was an interesting fact. But as we've grown and the competition and the number of breweries are grown, it is a discerning factor for us that people do come because we're women-owned. They'll come the first time before they're women-owned. They'll try our beer the first time because of that, but they won't come back unless the beer's great, the food's fantastic, and we have outstanding service. So that it maybe gives us that first opportunity, but then we really have to deliver.
Now, you've all brought some beers for us to taste. Deb, we're going to start with yours. What are we going to try today?
So this is our Cowbell Cream Ale. Joshua, this might even be a beer you might like. It's.
I didn't say I didn't like beer. Don't let that get around.
Well, it's...
Can I have a Shirley Temple, please? I'm a grown man.
It's lighter in color. But it still has a lot of flavor. But the reason I say you might like it, Joshua, is because it's very approachable. So it's lower in bitterness, it's refreshing, it's easy drinking. This is Cowbell Cream Ale is our biggest seller inside our tap room and outside the tap room. And it's actually named after the Minnesota State Fair. Jill, my partner, is a big State Fair fan, so it's named after a cowbell, but also, who doesn't like to say, I need more cowbell?
All right, let me give this a sip. Here we go. That's very good. I mean, what else am I going to say?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Tell me what you were going for with the flavor of this beer.
So I did want it to be a lot very approachable, so broad appeal, so transition beer. So people that might be used to drinking American lagers, but this has a lot more character. So bringing some of those conventional beer people into our craft brewer's fold, it's very approachable, very drinkable. Even on a winter day or a cold summer day, it's perfect. And you can have more than one. One of the things as when you market to women, you want to have an alcohol level that's approachable, so you can have more than one.
John, talk about how beers like this, kind of the wide spectrum appeal, fits into the craft beer market. I think when people think of craft beer, they think of very specific with very like unique and bespoke tastes.
Right. And I think beers like this are really important because for as popular as craft beer has gotten, it's still only about 13 or 14% of the overall national beer market. So that means 80%, you know, 87% of craft beer or of beer drinkers nationwide are not going drinking Cowbell Cream Ale or not drinking Surly Furious. They're drinking the Buds and Michelobes and the Millers. And so beers like this that have those kind of grainy, straightforward tastes that macro drinkers appreciate, but you can still tell a story with them, you can still say where the grain came from, why there's a local tie, and these kind of beers can still, can bring over those unconverted 87%.
We'll continue our conversation with John Garland from the Growler Magazine, Deb Locke from Urban Growler Brewing Company, and Omar Ansari from Surly Brewing Company. We'll bring some more voices in and get to some of your questions in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. Drinking on the job! It's driven me to this. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Bonnie, a Home Instead caregiver, knows that building trust is essential to forging strong relationships with her Home Instead clients.
I seen the ad in the paper and I called, and 3 days after I was hired, I was with my very first client. You've got to have patience in order to be a good caregiver. You've got to build up the trust. I just love it. I couldn't ask for a better job or a better client.
To learn more or to search for available senior care job opportunities with Home Instead Senior Care, visit homeinstead.com.
If you love this show, then check out Life Kit, tools to help you get it together. Think of it as that friend who always has great advice on everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. Subscribe to Life Kit All Guides to get episodes on every topic all in one place. Find it in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson at the Minnesota State Fair discussing the state's craft beer business. So we just tried Deb's beer. I'd like to get reactions from John and Omar. John, what'd you think?
It's a fantastic beer. It's been, you know, Deb's flagship for you know, since they've started. And it's cream ales are a really, really good way to convert those macro drinkers into craft drinkers. It's those same kind of flavors you appreciate from you know, bigger beers, but made locally and made well. It's really spectacular.
I'm sorry, macro drinkers?
Yeah, so macro drinkers. We're talking about Bud, Miller, Coors, the big industrial macro lagers.
Omar?
Perfect beer for the fair. It's a summer crusher. Like Deb said, a lower ABV beer. So I've seen some people that are drinking early and drink all day at the fair, and you know, drinking 7-8% beers makes it hard to drink all day.
ABV?
Alcohol. So the amount of alcohol in the beer, and your macro beers, Bud Miller, Coors, they'll have like a 4.5%. Deb, what is this one at?
A little over 5.
Yeah, so it's a beer that you can have a number of them. Some of the craft beers can, you know, get 6-8%.
Omar, let me get to your beer now. We'll try it in just a minute, but tell me a little bit more about how you started Surly Brewing.
Well, like Deb, I was a home brewer. That's really where things got started for me. And back in 2004, while home brewing, got the idea of opening a brewery. It was a very different time in the Minnesota beer scene. There was not very many breweries at all. And it seemed like an opportunity. My big question was, could the Twin Cities support two breweries? So somebody had already been around for quite a long time in brewing craft beers. And that was my thought. I'm like, man, I don't know if the Twin Cities could handle another one. And it seems now, what do we have, John, 80 craft breweries in the
Twin Cities? Yeah, around 80 in the cities.
So the answer is yes, they could support more than one brewery. And that's really where I got going, converted my folks' old business. We had a tiny little manufacturing company, turned it into a brewery. Started in 06, and things really exploded for us our second year. Took us years to make enough beer to keep up with the market demand.
All right. Tell us about the beer we're going to be tasting from you.
Well, this is Sideshow Spritzer. What this beer is, a wine-inspired beer. So this is a lager. We have a beer called Rosé that has been out there for a while and was kind of our first foray into a wine-esque beer. And what we've done with this one is this is more Sauvignon Blanc-inspired, and it's got some notes of, it has some passion and mango fruit in it. So there's a nice tartness to it. Which is one of those things we think works really well at the fair, a beer that's clean. You're eating so many big foods and drinking all day, so you want to have something that kind of cleans the palate.
Okay, let's see how my palate feels after this. Stand by. Hold on a second. Yeah, I taste the kind of fruitiness that you're talking about. Now, what is it about this beer and these beers, really, that make them Minnesotan? Is that what you're going for? Is there a certain kind of flavor spectrum or style or feel or effect that makes it kind of bespoke to the state, or is it not quite that deep?
Go ahead.
I would say as a lot, us Minnesota craft brewers are pretty adventurous. So you might not think about that as a Midwestern trait, but I think we cover a lot of ground. And so Minnesotan here at the State Fair especially, anything goes, and I think you heard Dan talk about mini donut beer, and we're always looking for different challenges and opportunities to use some of our local ingredients.
Deb, what'd you think of Omar's beer?
I think it's great. This, as craft brewers too, we're always trying to appeal to a broader audience, and sometimes the fruitier, more acidic beer appeals to wine drinkers. So if we can get a wine drinker, someone who says, I don't like beer, perhaps they should try this beer.
John?
Yeah, Omar mentioned earlier his beer, Rosé, and since that has come out, and this is exactly like it, a spectacular way to try to convert wine drinkers over to craft beer. I mean, this is, it's made with a wine yeast, which is a really good way of drying out a beer at the finish, so it's not, doesn't have residual sweetness, and like the Rosé beer that's made with flowers and currants as well, it finishes so dry, it's pretty pink, and it looks exactly, and almost tastes exactly like a Southern French Rosé.
Let me add one more voice to our conversation here. Joining in the conversation now is Eric Sennerud. He's the founding farmer of Mighty Axe Hops. Eric, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
Now, I understand you operate an 80-acre hops farm, Mighty Axe Hops, which is the largest between Michigan and Iowa, but most breweries import their hops from the West Coast, right?
Yeah, or Europe or overseas, yeah.
So I imagine that you're also kind of playing into the benefit of having local craft brewers being able to buy their hops in-state.
Absolutely. That's what we came around to be. So make local craft beer really truly local by offering high quality hops that were actually grown in the state.
Explain quickly for those who may not know beer very well, raising my hand, what hops are and what they do.
Hops are like the spice of beer. That's the easiest way to describe them. They're what make the beer bitter. They're actually the preservative in beer. So you can thank hops that your beer doesn't have all this weird crap in it. And they're the smell, the flavor, the aroma of the beer.
How'd you get into this business?
I liked beer and farming, and 6 years later, we're doing it for real.
Which one did you fall for first, beer or farming?
It's hard to say. They're kind of both same time.
They kind of dovetailed. And when did you decide that hops was the right business to be in? I mean, how long have you been in business?
This is our sixth season growing hops, so it's been 6 years with hops, and that kind of mirrors the rise of craft beer, and without the explosion from 12 to 180, it would have never have made sense to grow hops outside the traditional commodity growing regions.
Now, John, I have more questions for you, yeah. Eric, but John, I'm noticing, because I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for a while, mm-hmm. and have been to more than one wine tasting, and a lot of the same terms that I heard at wine tasting, a certain fruitiness, the terroir, they're coming up again with craft beers.
Yep.
And I'm not sure what to make of that because, on one hand, it allows enthusiasts and aficionados to know what they're getting, to be very deeply involved in the thought process behind, I want this beer for this region, from this grower, and it's from this city, and it meets this need. On the other hand, people who don't speak the language are like, that is exactly why I don't like wine aficionados. Just like, you know, give me some you know, $20 hooch from Walmart and I'm good.
Right.
I'm not sure what to make of this.
Yeah, no, it's definitely part of craft beer's approachability that we need to, you know, in this sort of second stage of growth in craft brewing, you know, this first stage has really gone on the strength of the product. It's said, look, we're delivering a better product and you need to drink this. But for the people that aren't persuaded just on the quality of the product alone, there has to be a little more outreach to say, like, why these products are specifically good. And what Eric is doing right now is and other farmers doing sort of sensory trials on the raw materials is something that really has not been done in craft brewing a whole lot. So when Eric is doing, you know, scientific research into, you know, what characteristics a hop can express when it's grown in a certain way, and also farmers are doing the same kind of sensory trials on grains as well. So the more we kind of figure out what makes those raw materials endemic to the state, and what if we realize that those raw materials do have a very specific way of expressing themselves in the final product, that can be a way to start. You know, we can get off the subject of terroir and say, taste this Minnesota hop, it's good. We can throw those wine terms by the wayside and just go forward on the strength of the product.
I'm not knocking a good terroir. I'm just saying, you know, if you ask me to spell it, I'd be wrong. Derek from Circle Pines has a question. Derek, what's on your mind?
Yeah, first off, thank you for highlighting Minnesota craft beer. It's awesome. My question is, how can Minnesota liquor laws improve?
I'd love to hear from any of you on that, but Omar, let me start with you.
Well, beer and politics go hand in hand. There's certainly, each state has its own unique set of rules that kind of came about after Prohibition, and Minnesota's has traditionally been a little more conservative. And some of those changes we've seen in the laws has led to the explosion of craft breweries across the state and jobs also. So as far as making more changes and craft breweries, there's always some tweaks that each brewery, because we're all a little bit different, so there's some rules that would certainly help us all grow in the marketplace. So really the biggest way to get those laws changed are like anything, get to know your legislator, call, email. That's really what makes the difference. That's how the taproom bill got done years ago. Was really it's the consumer that really makes the difference, because if you have a couple business people asking for something, that's usually not enough, but it's the consumers, the people that drink the beer, that really make the difference.
I'd love to get some more of your takes on that when we continue our conversation with Omar Ansari, Deb Locke, John Garland, and Eric Santarud. We'll get to some more of your comments and questions as well, particularly about the beers that you like and where they come from. Also want to address some of the criticism of craft beers. We've gotten a few comments to the effect of what Mr. Anderson tweeted. Mr. Anderson writes, "Most craft beers just aren't good. I'm an artisan and engineer, so craft beer is right up my alley, but most just add a chocolate or a fruit flavor and a funny name and think it's mind-blowing. It's not, and it takes many craft beers to find one worth drinking." John, I'd love you to respond to that when we come back, and we will continue tasting some beers. I'm told we've got a lemon meringue pie ale. We're going to talk a little bit more about lemon meringue pie ale next. Stay close. Thank God for healing. You ain't got to get me lit. I got my own life. Thank God for listening. Listen, you've been trying to build me up my whole life.
Support also comes from Rothy's. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. Stylish, versatile, fully machine washable, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Best of all, there's zero break-in period thanks to their woven design, seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Find out why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes at rothys.com/1A.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
This is Elise Spiegel from Invisibilia, and guess what? We just launched a fall season where we're trying new things. Monthly stories that are a little bit shorter, feature new voices and new kinds of storytelling and sound. Our first fall story is about a man and the thing that he loves most, which is a giant plastic elephant. You should definitely tune in.
Back now to our conversation with John Garland, Deb Locke, Omar Ansari, and Eric Santarud. Let's respond to Mr. Anderson, who tweeted, "Most craft beers just aren't good. I'm an artisan and engineer, so craft beer is right up my alley, but most just add a chocolate or fruit flavor and a funny name and think it's mind-blowing. It's not, and it takes many craft beers to find one worth drinking." Reactions to Mr. Anderson? John?
Yeah, the problem of quality in craft beer is a big one. It might be the biggest problem the industry faces right now. I think the kind of the standard story about how a lot of breweries started up was this person was a systems analyst for 15 years, lost their job in the Great Recession, didn't have anything to do, so started home brewing. And once the economy started pick back up, their hobby became a business and they started scaling up. And that's great, but also there's a lot more that goes into commercial brewing than home brewing. I mean, it's not just it's a difference of making 5 gallons of beer in a bucket in your basement and making thousands and thousands of gallons on very expensive equipment in a big brewery. And you can't just scale up your ingredients times the same factor and get the same result. There's a whole lot of other processes that go into it. And I think that it's imperative for the craft brewing industry to really invest in quality assurance and quality control measures. It's expensive. It's time-consuming, and a lot of small breweries just don't do it. And if you're not on the front lines making sure that every beer you pour is free of sensory flaws, it's free of process flaws, then you're putting out a bad beer into the market, and it might not necessarily show itself as a problem right away, because to their credit, consumers are coming in with faith in the industry. They say, this is local, this is small batch, this was made by my neighbors, therefore it must be good, right? And so they're giving us the benefit of the doubt, but then a lot of times that benefit is not being honored, I think. So small breweries and large breweries, to their credit, open up their quality assurance labs to smaller breweries. They're all also independent businesses that offer chemical and sensory analysis of beers, and smaller breweries really have to do that a lot more.
All right, let's talk about this lemon meringue pie. Because the State Fair is a time when some local brewers take risks, some successful, some not, and they show off some offbeat brews. Nate Janicek is the owner of the Hangar Bar and Restaurant. Here he is talking about his bestseller, the Lemon Meringue Pie Ale from Lupulin Brewing Company in Big Lake, Minnesota.
This isn't a beer you would go and have in your fridge to drink every day. Just like you wouldn't eat funnel cakes every day and you wouldn't eat cotton candy and candy apples every day. But when you come to the fair, you're looking for a flavor, you're looking for an experience, you're looking for some foods and some drinks that are not something you do every day. You do it once a year. It's whimsical, it's free, it's fun, you know. It's not free, but it's free, like, you know, you're free. Like, you're a kid when you're here, no matter how old you are.
It's free? I think you just made a lot of new customers. That's Nate Janicek, the owner of Lupulin Brewing Company, owner of the Hangar Bar and Restaurant, with his best-selling beer, the Lemon Meringue Pie Ale, from Lupulin Brewing Company in Big Lake, Minnesota. Shall we try this? All right, some of you already took your sips. You are way ahead of me. Hang on one second. I am a swirl of emotions. Because no. I taste the lemon very distinctly. It's not strong, but like it's there. But I do, my brain is like, you should be having this flavor after eating something solid, and you just drank something, but no, it's not like they threw a lemon meringue pie in a blender and gave it. It's like, John, what do you...
There's that kind of that biscuity character you get from the malt that kind of mimics the taste of pie crust,
That's
I think.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. Deb, Omar, Eric, what'd you think? My brain is kind of rebooting because that taste kind of caught me by surprise. It's not bad. It's just unique. I've never had it.
It's a great example of a state fair beer, which is something that started a few years ago with the mini donut beer from Liffbridge of coming up with flavors that mimic some food or that pair with something particular at the fair. So I think this is a great example of that. Like you said, like you wouldn't, you know, have four of these in the evening. There's just too much flavor in that. But I think it's a great, it does exactly what it's supposed to do at the fair, have some unique flavors in it.
Eric, I'd love to get your take on it for someone who sells a fundamental product of beer and then to have these kind of more unusual left-of-center flavors kind of layered on top of these fundamental ingredients of beer.
Well, I think it's really fascinating because there's this style of beer where there's got, you know, a gimmick or like a chase ingredient where you're trying to create a very unique experience is actually evocative of what direction traditionally brewed, you know, hoppy beers are going in. The thing to do now is to use hops that would mimic the flavor of a lemon meringue pie. In fact, we're probably, now that we've said it on the internet or on the air, we're, 1 or 2 months away from one of the houses that publish new hop varieties saying this is the lemon meringue hop. So it's actually not too far away from what you might experience from a hop profile.
There is a beer that uses Mighty Axe hops, Eric, and we're going to get to that in just a second. Let's get to some more of your questions. Needy emailed, beer is an agricultural product and hence has a big environmental impact. How are the producers on this show addressing these impacts? Eric, I see you nodding.
Well, we take that very seriously. We are a smaller farm. 80 acres sounds like a lot, but the average farm size for hops in America is about 800. So it's really easy for us to implement things like cover crop. You know, ultimately, what we do to the water at our farm affects the beer downstream. And so we take our water quality very seriously, and we look to minimize all of the kind of nasty inputs that go into farming and growing our food here in America. And so I think it's one thing that brewers get when they work more locally or directly at the farm is the understanding of the environmental impact of their ingredient sourcing.
Deb, Omar, what about you? How do you deal with the environmental impact of your breweries?
I think in our part, the biggest thing we can do is constantly try and reduce water usage, which is really one of the biggest issues, and just continue to try and get more efficient equipment in the brewery. We went from a boiler that used a lot of natural gas to one that's just much more efficient, and I think it's just that constant for us trying to move towards equipment that uses less energy, wastes less natural resources is kind of the constant goal of the brewers at Surly, and I think most breweries.
Deb?
Well, we really try to look at what our waste products are and how can we reuse those things, how can we reduce those things, so composting, using leftover grain for feed, recycling water. As much as we can reduce our waste products, that's really what we try to do every day.
Let's get to Sarah's question. Sarah, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. And so excited to have all of you guys here. Can I give a really quick shout out? My husband and I had our wedding celebrations past summer, and we used a farm-to-table theme. So our drink of choice was Mighty Axe Hops Fair State IPA, and that's all that we served that day. Anyway, so my question is, what do you guys feel is the next phase for craft beer, and how do we keep it relevant within Minnesota?
Next phase for craft beer.
Wow.
John?
I mean, there's definitely going to be, and we're seeing it right now, a diversity of products being made by breweries. So there are a lot of breweries that are jumping on the hard seltzer train, some that are messing around with alcoholic teas and other kind of hard sodas even. So there's definitely going to be a diversity of products being made by breweries because, again, only 13% of America are craft beer drinkers, and the breweries that are going to be making inroads into that other 87 are going to try to find other beverages to get them with.
Eric?
I think that, like, nationally, when you look at, I always imagine it this way, the overlap of the farmer's market crowd and the craft beer crowd is a lot. You draw that Venn diagram, it looks like two circles touching. And I think that transparency and the consumer knowing more about what's actually in their beer, look, we all know hops, barley, water, lemon meringue, pie, but where is that stuff from? Yeah. Who grew it? What were the environmental implications of that? How many beer miles are in my beer? I think that transparency, just like what we've seen come to food, is on its way to beer.
Let me get to one more beer we're going to taste. And Eric, I'm going to turn to you because this one uses Mighty Axe Hops, which is available here at the fair. It's the Minnesota Haze IPA from Lakes and Legends Brewing Company in Minneapolis. Uses 100% Minnesota ingredients. What else can you tell us about it before we take a sip?
This one is near and dear to my heart. It's 100% our hops, and it features two of our varieties that we've twisted the names around to really highlight that the influence that terroir, the ability of where they're grown, affects how hops taste, and this beer showcases that. This beer is using Julius and Tropica hops, which are genetically very common hop varieties, but because of them being grown here by us and harvested in a certain way, you get a really unique flavor. So this beer is just all over that. It smells like pineapple. It smells like oranges. It's a little sweet. The bitterness is a little bit more forward on your tongue. And I know this all set, terroir and bitterness and tongue. I mean, but really, local ingredients for local beer is as blue collar as it gets. That's keeping so much more money in the state. It's living that local economy story to the very end.
All right, let's give this Minnesota Haze a taste. Stand by. Hold on. Yeah, I could smell the pineapple-y before I tasted it. It is a little more, it's got a little more of a bite to it, kind of slaps you a little harder. But John, tell us more about this. What'd you think?
I think it's a great beer, and it's also indicative of what is a huge trend in craft beer right now, and that's the style of the hazy IPA. It is, by a lot of different metrics, one of the most popular styles of craft beer nationwide right now. It's different from other IPAs in the sense that it is hazy. You look through it, and it's unfiltered. It's turbid. You can hardly see through it at all. And it's a little less bitter than a regular IPA would be, because it has some of that yeast matter and mash kind of still in the beer. The palpable bitterness is a little bit lower. So hazy IPAs, talk about approachable, are very approachable. A lot of them have a very orange juice, pineapple juice kind of sweetness to them that a lot of non-beer drinkers, or certainly people that are turned off by a very bitter IPAs, really appreciate.
Before we go, I know we're low on time, but I wonder what suggestions, Deb or Omar, you would have for someone who's just diving into craft beers, other than drinking responsibly and handing over the keys. What other suggestions would you have for someone who's just getting into craft beer? Deb, briefly?
Going to a tap room is a great way to try a lot of different styles of beer. Just try it.
Omar?
Same thing. Get to know your bartender at a craft beer bar, tap room, or if you're at a liquor store, get to know the beer person. There's usually one there. And a lot of times you tell them what you like. They can steer you in a direction that maybe you wouldn't have ordered before, but give you an idea of what you're looking for.
Omar Ansari is the founder of Surly Brewing Company in Minneapolis. Omar, thanks for talking to us. John Garland, the deputy editor of The Growler magazine. John, thank you.
Absolutely.
Deb Locke, the master brewer and co-owner of Urban Growler Brewing Company in St. Paul. Thank you, Deb.
Thanks for having me.
And Eric Santarud, the founding farmer of Mighty Axe Hops. Eric, good to have you with us.
Thanks.
This program was produced by Avery Kleinman with help from Catherine Fink. It was edited by Miranda Fulmore. Amanda Williams was our beer tender. To learn more about the whole team, visit the1a.org/staff. Big thanks to Minnesota Public Radio for its help this week. You can find more of its great reporting online at mprnews.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Please drink responsibly, and we will see you tomorrow, bright-eyed and sober, for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.